We are the space robots. We are here to protect you. Back, Chewie, us. Back, Chewie, us. Back, Chewie, us.
All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pusher Robot.
And this is the Shover Robot.
And we're here to protect you from the terrible secret of space.
Yeah, space. And today begins the planet series. So get excited, because we're going to kind of wrap up a little tour of the solar system in a couple of episodes.
Yeah, pretty much. We've already covered several facets of the solar system. Awesome. Mostly we've been limiting it to moons, and we've talked about planets kind of in passing, but mostly in the context of whether they would be good habitats for humanity or, you know, other things relating to people. So today and next week, we'd like to go through and talk about each of our eight, you know, planets in detail, or at least in greater detail than we've covered them before. Basically, give you a good picture of these these planetary bodies and kind of what they're about, I suppose.
Yeah, some cool stuff about them you might not have known. And, you know, hey, if you're up into space and stuff, I mean, shoot, you got to know about the planets, so it should be pretty interesting.
Yeah.
We'll run through them real quick. We'll start with, obviously, the first one, which is Shover Station. No, I'm just kidding.
It exists
Mercury.
Inside the sun. It's just too hot. Yeah.
We will have to talk about the sun, though, eventually. I mean, it's kind of important, the giant ball of fusion that it is.
Yeah, indeed. So,
all right.
Mercury. It actually was discovered quite a bit earlier than I thought, because this is... I might just not be paying attention to this, but 1400 BC is quite a long time ago to have seen something that's really tiny and that exists so close to the sun that it basically gets sun washed out, because you can really only see it at twilight.
Yep.
Depending on where it is.
Yeah, the Assyrians were credited with the first documented, notification of Mercury. Which is pretty cool to think about, that they were thinking about astronomy and how important it was to write it down. I'm sure someone died when they discovered it, and it was like some big, giant hullabaloo, and, oh, this is an omen of goodness or badness, and who knows. Anyway.
Probably.
Yeah. The important thing is, it is super hard to see in the sky, so that is incredibly impressive. I think the best you can ever get is like 2 hours, I want to say.
Yeah, it's super hard to see, both because of that and because of just how small it is, you know, for a planet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
pretty
got a
stinking small.
Yeah, radius of 2,400 kilometers, give or take. So pretty little rocky body, and it doesn't really have much of an atmosphere, so it doesn't cause a lot of distortion around it. So it's pretty much just like picking up a rather large rock.
Yep, it's kind of like the moon, like a bigger moon. But it does have, and this is interesting fact,
moon
of Mercury,
harder.
Yeah, it does have a small atmosphere. What, Mercury, an atmosphere, you say? Preposterous. Ah, okay, it actually doesn't have an atmosphere, but it does steal one because it's a shiesty little planet. And it steals a slight atmosphere of solar wind particles. Every now and then, as the sun just outgasses tons and tons of energy upon the solar winds, some of it ends up being captured by the gravitational field, albeit small, of Mercury, and it pretends to have a nice little atmosphere.
And
by little, I mean like nearly a vacuum, but still detectable of stuff.
You don't want to breathe it, though, because
No. It's
charged particles.
It's charged particles.
That wouldn't be very nice. So other kind of weird things about Mercury is it was recently-ish discovered that it's got this kind of 3-2 orbital resonance, which means that every three orbits, it completes two rotations. Am I right? Or is it the other way around? I think it might be the other way around.
Okay. All right. So one...
It's every two orbits, it completes three rotations, because it kind of like flips around and does 1.5 rotations per orbit.
So essentially one Mercurian day?
Yeah,
we'll
go with that.
One Mercurian day lasts two Mercurian years long. So two Mercury solar days One Mercury solar day lasts 2 years on Mercury.
I think two orbits around. I think you got that backwards. It's one day lasts 2/3 of a year. Because you end up with, it's like 1.5 days per year. So you end up backwards to the sun at each year, and then you end up forwards to the sun at the end of two orbits. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I was saying, it's weird. And yeah. Something else that's really cool about this bizarre orbital resonance kind of deal is that once a year, and okay, so a year is 88 Earth days. That's the kind of metric that we're going to be using because why the heck not? We're all Earth-centric. That's fine. And a Mercurian day is about 58.6 Earth days. So it's a little bit shorter than the year, and that's why it's got this kind of bizarre flip-flopping deal. And because of this particular resonance in its orbit, it has, like, the sun comes up in the east and then gets up into the sky, and then once a year we'll kind of start going back towards the east and then start going back towards the west and then finally set. And it just has to do with the way that the planet kind of like drifts, for a better word. Like,
it's got a highly eccentric orbit,
yeah,
of 0.21, which is pretty high in compared to the rest of the planets.
I mean, not much in compared to Pluto if that was still a planet.
Well, yeah, but, so...
because that sucker just kind of, like, goes.
And for the non-indoctrinated, eccentricity is basically how much is it more of an ellipse than a circle. So, much more of an ellipse, or more of an ellipse than a circle, is Mercury's orbit around the sun.
Yeah. So, it is little, hard to find, and has some kind of bizarre properties. You probably wouldn't want to live on it. It's got low gravity, and it's really, really close to the sun. Like, the sun would look about 2.5 times larger on Mercury than it would here, and you would get a pretty bad sunburn pretty quickly.
Pretty stinking bad sunburn. And you'd also get pretty french fried, or maybe not french fried, but baked, because your maximum daytime temperature is approximately 800 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's like, you know, going, putting your oven on clean and then crawling inside of it for an afternoon's picnic. And in case you don't like the hot, it's okay, because we've got the nighttime for you, and the nighttime is about -315 degrees Fahrenheit. So, really, the place you want to live on is right at the daylight, day-night terminator, where things get crazy because it goes between 800 and -315.
Yeah.
Yikes.
So, not a very hospitable place. Even so, we've, you know, taken an interest in it. We've sent several missions there. The first one was the Mariner 10 in 1974. And that was our first look at Mercury up close at all by that point. 'Cause
it was.
Yeah, it's difficult to observe from Earth's atmosphere specifically because of the fact that it has to be observed in astronomical twilight kind of style. So you've got a lot of solar turbulence in the atmosphere that kind of distorts our vision towards that planet specifically. And then in, really, 2013... is the next time that we visited it.
It's kind of hard to get there. You have to play a lot of games with the different planets to do gravity slingshots so that you can lose enough energy to go downwards towards Mercury. I mean, you still have to spend Delta V to get down there, so it's expensive.
Mm-hmm. So I guess 2013 is the next time that we visited it, and we are planning on launching another probe in 2017, the Bepsi Colombo. Bepi Colombo.
Yeah. That's ESA's.
Yeah.
I do believe.
And it's going to take about 7 years to get there because of all the fancy orbital transfers that you need to take to get there, apparently.
Yep. Gotta love that orbital pinball.
It is a hard thing to hit. So, that's Mercury. Very nice. I recommend it. You know, if you're ever in the neighborhood, stop on by. All right, moving on to Venus, which was initially considered, if I'm not mistaken, it's still called Earth's sister planet just because it's just about as big as Earth is, but also because people were, like, pretty darn convinced that somebody else lived there, like another species lived there, and then we got a close look at it. And
yeah.
It's probably not happening.
And by close look at it, we mean we saw beneath the clouds, because Venus's clouds is what, by the way, makes it so darn bright, which allowed us to discover it, essentially, or at least note it very early antiquity. But it was recorded in 1700 BC by the Babylonians. I digress.
Yeah,
the clouds, basically, you can't see through them, and so it wasn't until, oh, goodness. Goodness. When would we get the radars up there? Want to say it was with Mariner 2 in 1962. Don't quote me on that one. Not 100% sure. Should do more research on that one. However, we did get radar imaging, finally, of Venus, and it is not a pretty picture. I mean, we're talking about hell incarnate.
Yep.
The whole planet.
So, yeah, Mercury, Venus, we're moving on. So, Venus is about the same size as Earth. It does have the bizarre retrograde rotation, which is unique to any planet that has a normal orbital orientation. Uranus doesn't count for this one because it's done on its side, so everything about it's just about retrograde. So it's got that kind of bizarre backwards rotation going, and it takes a while to get around the sun, 224 Earth days, and it takes even longer for the darn thing to spin on its axis, which is 243 Earth days per Venusian day. So, I mean, it's not like we can really tell that it's spinning very much. It's just covered in clouds anyway. Constant storms for days.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, something got real nasty with Venus early in the formation of that poor planet and, you know, whacked at something fierce. And that's what we believe is what caused its incredibly slow backwards rotation. It's basically it took out all its rotational energy and even sent it into a little bit of reverse.
Which is very interesting because when we got whacked, and by we mean the Earth, by Thalia?
I forget what they call it.
Whichever they call it. It's like that formed our moon, essentially. At least that's the prevailing theory. So if something smacked into Venus, it either got absorbed completely into the planet somehow, or it hit it so hard that the debris from it went somewhere else completely, because Venus has no moons, so it definitely didn't end up there. And because of the thick cloud layer, it's pretty difficult to tell the geological history of the planet in a sense of being able to, you know, say whether or not something did indeed impact it. In fact, the only thing that we've ever gotten to successfully land on Venus was the Venera 7 in 1970, and that's the one where if you look up pictures of Venus's surface, you'll only get one picture, and that's the one thing that it was able to send back to Earth before it melted. Because
melted and crushed.
Yeah, because, as we've said before, Venus has, I think, 92 bars of atmosphere, which is psychotically crushing, and it can melt lead basically on contact because it reaches the hefty temperature of 854 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's debatably, I suppose, more inhospitable than Mercury is for biological life, just because it's so, so bad.
Yeah, it's nasty up there. And the sulfuric acid clouds don't do you any favors either. I found it. So Magellan, that was it. Magellan.
Okay.
In 1989, NASA sent Magellan, and that's the one that took the pictures with the radar, and that's the one that we were able to see all the really cool stuff underneath those big shiny clouds.
Yeah. So in a thing of good news about Venus, because it seems like Venus is generally just bad news all the way around, is the Japanese space agency JAXA originally sent a probe called the Akatsuki to Venus in 2010, and it was expected to go into orbit, and they were going to map the surface using this probe, and they missed, unfortunately. And so it ended up orbiting the sun for about 5 years here, and then last year, late, they got a good window to make a burn that was way beyond the specifications for the probe, but managed to get it into the orbit of Venus in December of last year, and so the probe is finally able to start completing its mission of scanning Venus.
Yeah.
But it's super impressive that they were able to salvage that, because I mean, you know, working on engineering projects is tough enough, but you work on an engineering project for space, and that's like a whole different level of the things, you know, the amount of like gut-wrenching pain that you go through if something goes wrong, because that's years and years of planning and, you know, millions of dollars in funds and hundreds, if not thousands, of people involved in getting just like this one thing that's about this, the size of like a Mini Cooper,
you in have this box in the space.
Yeah, and then it like misses what you're trying to hit.
Somebody probably got fired when their astrodynamics was a little off.
Yeah, so it's really cool though that the probe is there, and we're looking forward to seeing, you know, what it brings back. It's obviously getting close to the end of its intentional mission lifespan, just because it spent so long around the sun. Mm-hmm. At like a distance of 0.6 AU or something like that, which is pretty close. But it's great that it was able to get back on track. So I'm stoked.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Also, you know, cool things about Venus. If you could design an spacecraft that could, you know, survive in Venus's atmosphere of, you know, sulfuric acid clouds and crushing pressures and extreme heats, if you're kind of up there in the atmosphere, you would fly pretty darn well because it's so darn thick. So that does, there have been proposals for sending probes to Venus that kind of just float around and fly around, which would be pretty easy and exciting.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely need like a full tungsten construction though, or something, you know, to survive the intense heat.
Yes.
But, or, you know, some, I mean, tungsten's heavy, so it'd have to be probably some lighter alloy. I don't know. It'd be really cool if we get to that point. I know Venus isn't super up on the list of things that we want to study, because it's obvious that a human colony, other than like a floating cloud city kind of deal, is not going to exist on Venus anytime soon. But it does give us a good hint as to what might happen if we let the climate change that's currently affecting our planet go too far. Because Venus is under a runaway greenhouse effect, meaning that they hit that tipping point sometime way back in their history where the carbon dioxide buildup was unable to be counteracted by whatever force was keeping it in balance before, whether that had been some kind of biological means or some other chemical means. And it just, it had too much.
Yeah.
And it just crashed out real fast. And that's, in fact, what we're worried is going to happen on Earth, is we'll hit that point where the solar radiation that we're containing is unable to be vented under any means at that point and just goes out of control, and we'll end up like a second Venus, basically.
That would be really bad.
Yeah.
I don't think it'd ever get that bad, but, you know, hey there. It's definitely a threat. I mean, Venus's orbit is 30% closer to the sun, so it's about getting twice as much sunlight than we are. That was, you know, theorized basically in the early formations of Venus that it had some nice water, that the proto-Venus and the proto-Earth were kind of similar, right? So we had some water. But that would evaporate a whole bunch of water, so you have an increased water vapor, which is, of course, going to affect the ability of the oceans and the surface rocks to hold carbon dioxide, which is where a lot of our carbon dioxide is in the oceans and in the surface rocks, and then Mars as well as on that same boat. So you get this nasty, nasty, nasty runaway effect because as you heat up, you have less things to hold it. And then that's the runaway greenhouse effect.
There you go.
But the runaway greenhouse effect would work very nicely on Mars.
Yeah.
Because that would help it.
That's what we want on that planet. So that's a great segue if I've ever heard one. Let's talk about Mars. So,
wait, isn't there like a planet in between Venus and Mars?
We don't care about that one. It's not important. We talking about the Nega Earth that people theorized about for as probably like early 19th century or early 20th century, that there was another planet exactly opposite of Earth with respect to the sun, so that we never saw it, but that was like the twin Earth.
I never heard that.
You never heard of that?
No, I didn't.
It was like a popular science fiction thing. I don't know. I don't think anybody of credible scientific basis ever actually believed that there was a second planet that was Earth-like on the opposite side of the sun, you know, there, just like mega Earthing.
There were some pretty crazy theories back in the day, though. I mean, people were living on the moon with like flying feathers, and you know, there was all sorts of things that we thought that might be, just to go and show you the imaginations of mankind and what we kind of hope to see and find out in space. And in some aspects, has been kind of less exciting, but in others, it's been far more exciting and interesting than we ever hoped it could be.
Pretty much.
Back to Mars.
Yeah, let's skip Earth. Okay, so Mars was discovered in 1534-ish in Egypt, so later than Venus, but earlier than Mercury. And that makes sense, because Mars is a little bit easier to see than Mercury, because it, you know, is out at night and not just around the twilight times. And it is also fairly bright. I mean, you can definitely tell that you're looking at a planet when you see it out in the night sky, but it's not quite as bright as Venus, because Venus is just like a lighthouse. So, Mars is cool because it's got very similar characteristics to Earth. It's a little bit smaller, and it's got 0.38-ish G's of gravity on its surface, or mean surface temperature. I think that's at its Martian sea level, which is kind of arbitrarily defined because of the whole fact that it doesn't actually have any seas to be level with. But it's got a rotation period that's slightly longer than Earth's by about 37 minutes, and its year is quite a bit longer at 687 days, Earth days, per Martian year. So it spins around quite a bit slower, but it rotates just about as fast. So anybody settling on the planet would not take too long to get used to the very slightly longer days.
Yeah, unlike its backwards sister planet Venus. Not sister planet, cousin planet.
Yeah, where it's just slow and backwards.
That's after you melt and, you know, crush under the pressure, though.
Yeah. In contrast, Mars has an average surface temperature of about negative 81 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, you know, don't get me wrong, freaking chilly, but is survivable with the correct equipment, certainly.
Yeah, there are definitely days on Mars and on Earth that share the same temperature in the winter times in some of the Great Plains, like in North Dakota. They'll actually be like, oh, hey, by the way, today is the same temperature on Earth as it is on Mars. How cool is that in the wintertime? But, hey, also, you know, Mars in the summertime at the equator, I mean, you're pushing 70 degrees sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for like a couple days.
So, I mean, it's, you know, it's not that bad comparatively. And as such, we've taken many opportunities to look at this planet, and there are so many missions to this planet, and it's so sad because about 2/3 of them have crashed or missed, or crashed and missed, or blown up on the way there, or something. So, I mean, there's in engineering school, we always get told the story of the Mars lander that couldn't, where it was NASA was working with a European contractor. I think it was a British contractor, and the British contractor were working in imperial units, and NASA was working in metric units, and somebody in the code didn't remember to comment which units they were using in a certain function call, and so one assumed the other, and basically the end of it was the lander crashed into Mars at close to the speed of sound kind of deal, because it thought it didn't need to slow down yet, or maybe it thought it was going too slow or something like that.
Yeah,
but
its recovery system thought that it was going a-okay and that it was at the wrong altitude, so it didn't
comment your code.
Yeah,
that's what we're saying here. So we visited Mars as a race first in the 1960s, when we were trying, the Soviets were just shooting things at it like crazy. And Mariner 4, which was a United States craft, was the first one to make an actual flyby in 1965, around the middle of that year. And that's where we got our first look at Mars, you know, up close, that actually sent stuff back to Earth. And then Mariner 9, which I don't know what happened to Mariner 6 through 8, or 5 through 8. I think they missed or crashed or didn't take off. But Mariner 9 entered orbit in 71, and then, like, later that month, the Soviets landed, Mars 2 and Mars 3 are on the surface, and kind of showed us up.
Yep.
Which is good. You know, I mean, we got stuff on the planet. Huge leap forward for science. And then in 76 is when we got the Viking 1 and Viking 2 spacecrafts during that launch window in 75 that took them a year to get there. And that was the first major, like, full scientific equipment bases on the planet that gave us a really good idea of what Mars was like.
And it wasn't all rivers and stuff. I mean, this was when Mars was deemed to be a dry planet and there was no water. So it was kind of a cool turn point in the understanding of Mars where we thought, hey, there might be canals and these rivers and stuff. And they're like, nope, definitely not. Only recently have we come to find out that there is actually more water on Mars than we thought that we didn't think that there was water on Mars. So
yeah, and we were coming to the realization that there's a lot of water all throughout the solar system that we just didn't have the technology to discover until this point. And there are many more Mars missions that we could talk about, but we'll skip forward quite a bit to the Pathfinder missions and then our three favorite rovers that have been kicking around on Mars for a lot longer than they theoretically should have been, just because they won't stop moving.
Must have the right spirit. They're very opportunistic, you might say.
Great curiosity. They have.
Oh, terrible. Terrible
so, months. Yeah. And we've been getting gobs of data back from all of our rovers that we've sent there. And there are further rover missions planned in the future because it just seems to work out so well. And with each of them, we're learning, you know, much, you know, more and more about different places on Mars since we've sent them all, of course, to different locations to get a wide breadth of knowledge. So it's definitely looking like we'll be having human visits to Mars probably within the next decade and a half, 2 decades, which is really cool.
Absolutely. And I just can't help but get over the fact that the Curiosity is freaking awesome. That rover... And how they got it down. I mean, this thing's the size of a minivan. I mean, it's giant compared to Pathfinder or Spirit Opportunity. Pathfinder is about the size of a small dog, and you've got Spirit Opportunity, kind of like an ATV size or a four wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
And then this guy, freaking Curiosity, is no joke the size of a minivan, and so big was it that you couldn't just get down there on the regular bounce around on these balloons or anything. So you had to have a bunch of different parachutes to slow it down. They used aerodynamic drag to slow it down. And then on top of that, they used a sky crane, which is the coolest thing I've ever seen and heard about, which is basically a jetpack with a crane on it so that it would slowly lower the Curiosity rover and then jet itself away after it detached its cables and crashed off somewhere away from it.
Yep. So, seriously cool stuff. I remember in college watching that go down, and there was this, it was pretty much all the classes that day were just everybody was talking about the sky crane. And I guess that's what you get when you go to an aerospace college.
Pretty much.
Is everybody's just like, oh my god, I don't care what we're talking about, sky crane.
Space!
Space is wicked.
What's up? And here we are, still talking about space.
Yeah. So, there you go. That's how it rolls. So, that concludes our tour of the inner planets. Next week, we're going to talk about the outer planets. But before we sign off, there have been a couple of big planet stories in the news recently that we just wanted to gab about real quick. The first one is, of course, Planet 9 from outer space, which is making headlines quite frequently. And that's where a few scientists have semi-statistically proven that there is a ninth planet out beond the orbit of Pluto in the Oort cloud. And although it's highly, conjecture right now, and NASA is super skeptical that such a body exists, but I encourage you to go out and check out a few of the articles on it, because it's pretty interesting stuff that there is possibly this large,
another Jovian-type planet.
Yeah, just kind of hanging out there that we haven't seen yet. And it's totally, that stuff is totally possible that there are just planets out there, because gravity bleeds off, quite rapidly as you go out. But that doesn't mean that it has no effect. And so you can have big planets that just start hanging a ways away from their sun. And with them being so far away, it's kind of hard to find them from our little rock.
Yep. And it's not unheard of, too. I mean, the discovery of Uranus and Neptune were almost 100 years apart. And they thought that they had planets out there, like between, past Saturn. Mm-hmm. And it took them a while. Like they had and I forget the exact stories, and we'll talk about it in next week when we talk about the other Jovian planets. So it's not far-fetched that you have these giant planets way out there that you can detect some sort of gravitational tug on something. You're like, what's causing that? Maybe there's a large mass of something out there that we just haven't quite accounted for yet.
And if you want to talk about large planets really far away, we can't stop without talking about two-mass J2126, which got discovered, I think, last week. We've known about the planet, but what we discovered here in the last week and a half is that this planet, which is how much bigger than Earth? I think like 7,000 times the size. That's the orbit. It's big. It's bigger than Jupiter, and we thought that it was a rogue for the longest time because it didn't orbit around any star. And then recently we learned that the reason we couldn't find the star is because the star is 1 trillion kilometers away from the planet, and its orbit takes 900,000 years to complete because it's so far away from its star. And wow. It's currently being called, it is most definitely the largest solar system that we know of to date because of just how big this thing's orbit is. So, solar systems are big. They're definitely not constrained by, things as simple as logic.
Which is exciting to think about that we're still learning new stuff.
Yeah.
I gotta love it. You gotta keep it real. Gotta learn new things every day. Otherwise, life just gets boring. But I don't think we're ever gonna run out of exciting things to find out, especially in space.
Yep, space is full of fun. So yeah, it's pretty much. So I believe that is all the time that we have for this evening. Until then, I am the Pusher Robot.
And I am the Shupper Robot.
And you have gone.
Down the stairs. Stay classy. About that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space.